everyone. Yes, welcome to the Delta Flyers. We are so excited to have the one and only Terry Farrell. Terry,
yes, welcome. Terry, welcome.
I love you guys. I'm so happy to be here.
This is
so
kind of like an appetizer. It's like an appetizer because, you know, they get to have a little bit of Terry now and then more Terry later in the future. So
yes,
we're very happy to have you. Yeah.
I'm happy to be an appetizer.
Yeah. All right. So starting from the beginning, you were born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, correct?
Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Cedar Rapids is northern Iowa. Is it like closer to Chicago or is it closer to Missouri or where is it?
It's southeast Iowa.
Southeast. Okay.
So Chicago is like a 4-hour drive.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Iowa City is where you fly in to go to Cedar Rapids, which I see. Is really close. But Iowa City is where the Hawkeyes are.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. All right.
So and we were Hawkeye fans.
Of course, as you should be. And why were you guys in Iowa at the time? Why were your parents there?
What did they do?
What did they do back then? You know,
my mom was a hairdresser when I was a kid.
Oh.
She moved from Minnesota. My birth father, I don't know the history of where why his family was in Iowa, or I don't remember it. He left when I was 4.
Oh.
But my stepdad, who adopted me when I asked him to adopt me when I was 19, was a data systems analyst for hospitals, and he wrote computer programs when computers were the size of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, they were gigantic, or they took up whole rooms, right?
Yeah, massive. So that's what he did. Okay.
That's funny. Yeah. Your stepfather worked in computers around the same time my father worked in computers for General Electric Company. He did data sales and customer service. All the companies that would use GE computers for their data processing and things, he would deal with them and figure out what they needed and then talk to the techs about how to make that work. But yeah.
Look at the parallels.
Yeah. That is so cool.
Old computers.
Like these big stacks of that.
The paper.
Uh-huh. Thinking like, oh my, he would never make a big deal about anything. He's such a humble man. I mean, he's 85 now. He's amazing. Plays tennis and everything.
Oh, that's awesome.
I didn't get his genes up here, but he's a very smart man.
Did he bring, did he ever have those teletypes, those computers like that look like a suitcase? My father would bring them home. And it was as big as a suitcase and it had a hard shell. You take the top off and then he'd go to our phone on the wall and
the phone in.
Dial a number and stick the phone in to the side of this teletype, it was called. And then he could work from home. Did your stepfather have that?
I don't remember that, but I do remember those.
Yeah.
I don't remember him doing that, but I do remember those.
Yeah. My father would bring it home occasionally. It wasn't an everyday thing, but he'd bring it home if he had a project
or make an impact on you.
Oh yeah.
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 And the cards.
The cards. Yes. All those computer cards.
Boxes of cards. Like, whoa. So
funny that you and I had a lot of that in our lives growing up.
Yeah.
Those old school parallels. Yeah.
What was it like growing up in Iowa?
Well, we didn't have very much money. So most of our trips or vacations were car trips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Same.
Yep. And I remember my first stepfather used to, not my dad, would take us in the car to chase storms.
Oh, wow.
I remember him holding me and my sister under his arms to put us in the car. So we must have been like 3 and 4. I was 4 and Chris was 3. And driving to my grandparents' house, like on Sundays for dinner. And when we would drive home, and this is one of the things I love about where I live right now in New Mexico, there are no street lamps, but I remember driving home before there were highway lights.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'd stare at the stars the whole way, the whole hour and a half to going back, right? And I loved it so much. Not going there, but I love staring at
coming
the stars
back
on the way home. Mm-hmm.
That's so funny. It brings up a memory for me. We had a Pontiac when I was young, and it had a very long sloping rear window. And
yes.
I would climb up into the back where the speakers, like the stereo speakers, because that long sloping window, and I could lay
you would lie
under.
There.
Yes. Yeah. Clearly my parents didn't care about seat belts or anything like that.
No, nobody did at the time though.
Nobody did.
My dad, now he had a Tornado, and I was skinny enough that I was the one that could fit in the very back there.
Yeah.
I have four sisters. So
You would lay and you would watch the stars, because we'd take trips to see family. And I remember those drives home at late at night, looking at the stars through the and we both went to the stars. We both ended up
on
spaceships.
We both went to the stars. Isn't
Look at the
crazy?
Parallels here. This is crazy. It really is.
That's
okay.
Crazy.
Let's talk about did you do school plays or anything when you were in grade school?
Get,
anything
yeah.
like that? When did the acting bug hit you? Did any of that happen in primary school, middle school, or high school at all?
I think maybe this has to do with being a kid from the 60s, or maybe it's just, you know, kind of part of being a kid. But I always kind of performing, like, I don't know what it
like
was.
Like in front of your parents, that kind of stuff, and with your sisters,
that
maybe?
That
What would you perform? Would you perform songs or plays?
Terry and I did, stepsister Terry and I did a whole dance to Crocodile Rock. And made up plays, and Evel Knievel was big, and I remember having this, I think I was probably like maybe 5 or 6, and I thought I had this purple bike with a banana seat, and I was gonna jump off of it and onto the sidewalk. Well, I missed and I landed in a gravel pit.
No. Terry,
crazy,
I can't believe
stuff like that.
You had the banana seat bike and loved Evel Knievel. I was the same. Me and my friends had the Schwinn Stingray, which was the Stingray was that bike that had the banana seat and the big handlebars. And we built ramps and we would do Evel Knievel kind of like reenactments. And we'd jump and see who, and we'd mark it with like chalk on the street. Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. I just did this in my head.
Yeah.
I had no ramp. I just.
And then you ended up in a gravel pit.
I ate a lot of rocks. And like everyone's so excited to see you like do it.
It's dangerous.
It's
you're doing
it's
your own stunts,
dangerous.
Basically.
And then the look on their faces when I hit the blood everywhere, just that's
oh no.
I do a lot of things where I don't think them all the way through.
Ah. Okay. Very insightful.
So you did this growing up with your family and your and friends, just performing and things. When was the first time you took it to the next level of like formal, like a, was it a school play? Was it modeling? Is that sort of.
In junior high, I did a lot of musicals.
Uh-huh. Oh, you did. You did.
In high school. Yeah. In high school, I read for a play, but we had to, it was one of those where they had to sing Happy Birthday. Who can sing Happy Birthday, right? In the auditorium. And I was so nervous and so embarrassed, and the auditorium was so huge compared to our junior high and that it was too scary, and I never auditioned for a play again.
Wow.
But I went to a modeling school, and they told me that they thought I was photogenic, so I took pictures. And one of these women, Linda Anderson was her name, and she at the time she thought I should mail my pictures into the agencies. And at the time, Cosmopolitan had a book of all the agencies you could buy.
Oh, wow. The
Manhattan Handbook is what it was called.
Right.
So I got that with my babysitting money, and I had all the addresses for all the modeling agents, and I sent my pictures out, and the first batch came back, told me, remember too, in the 70s, women, we plucked our eyebrows. Like, like this big thing in the front, and then it was like a pencil line.
Yeah.
Let your eyebrows grow out, or you're too tall.
You got you're too tall? Literally. Oh, yeah. Come on.
Well, the average model was 5'8".
Oh.
I did not know that. But even when they make a big thing about tall models, 6 feet tall, it's not an easy models that are 5'8" that are going to make the most amount of money because they fit. It's like a last for a shoe. How they design the clothes is to fit on someone who's between, 5 feet and 5'8".
Right.
Not 6 feet, 6'3", or anything like that.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was really tall.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I mean, being 6 feet tall and a woman in born in 1963 was like, whoa. It was like, I was the tallest. I wasn't tallest in school until high school.
What about your sisters, though? Were they also as tall as you?
My sister, Chris, we have the same mom and dad.
Yeah.
No, Chris is shorter than me. I don't remember. I think she's like 5'6".
Oh my goodness. That's a big difference.
And my stepsisters were not biologically related. So.
Right.
Oh, right. Okay. One agency did respond and say, we love you. Yes.
So the second set of pictures, my eyebrows are grown out, but I just did 3 headshots and I sent them out, and Elite Model Management, a lady named Gara Morris called me, and it was the August before my junior year of high school, and said, we have your pictures and we're going to go on a scouting mission and we'd like to come see you. And if you look like your pictures, we'd like to sign you.
Wow.
Well, I knew I looked like my pictures.
Right.
And so they came and they signed me. And I, from that, the beginning of my junior year, I took every credit I could. And I didn't spend a dollar. I saved all my money to from babysitting. And I worked as an art assistant at a recreation center for a potter. And that was one of my favorite jobs ever, was working with the artist. She was really cool.
Huh.
And so I saved all my money from that. And we drove out from Cedar Rapids to New York City and stayed at the model's apartment.
What was the span of time between when you got the okay from them and then you were saving all that money to actually drive out? Like, what was that time?
Okay, so this is August.
Yeah.
The beginning of the school year, before school starts, they came out.
Right.
Then we're talking Christmas time was the next time I had a break and my parents could take time and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was August, September, October, November, December, 4 months.
Yeah.
So I needed to go to New York City to get test shots done.
Correct.
Like real
professional photographers. And you don't get paid for this. So I know a little bit about modeling, but I'll tell you what I know and then you can correct me. So when young girls get signed from out of New York City, these agencies keep apartments for young people coming in and they kind of help set you up with a place to stay. And they have all these photographers that will take pictures of you for free. The photographers own those images technically, but you can get copies of it for your portfolio, which helps you get paying jobs.
I would just correct that. I had to pay for my rent in the apartment.
Your housing.
Oh, you do? Apartment.
Yes, it's not free. They don't they set you up with the opportunity to stay there, right?
But you have to pay.
So I still have to pay rent. Yeah.
So you're sharing a room?
4 girls in a room.
What part of town was that apartment?
87th and 3rd.
Oh, that's not a bad neighborhood. That's not too bad.
And it wasn't bad. And I moved there June 81.
Oh, yeah. I was in New York 82.
At the end of my junior year.
So I remember New York in those days.
Is that Upper West or Upper East Side, what she just said? Where is that? That's Upper East Side. Okay.
Yeah. And what happened was we did the test shots and I'm there with my mom and my aunt in New York City on 87th and 3rd, 3rd Avenue. So it's East Side. Yeah. And we went and saw a couple of plays, but we didn't have very much money. So you go to Ticketmaster. And it was before the whole world knew about Ticketmaster, right? So you go the day of and it was a long line, but now it's like chaos, right?
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It's insanity. And what's really weird is we saw this Tommy Tune, what was it, bringing up baby or babies?
Sugar Babies.
My One and Only. I saw Sugar Babies and My One and Only, and I think Nana was in one of those. I didn't know Nana then.
Wow.
No way.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, and so my sister and my dad went ahead and drove to New Hampshire, which is where my aunt lived. My aunt has her car with us. And so when I'm done with my test shots, my aunt is driving me and my new agent from Elite in the car. And my mom, we're going to drop her off in Boston and go the rest of the way to New Hampshire. And on the way, she's looking at the pictures of me and she went, "Oh my God, you're gonna be a cover girl." And I was like, I had goosebumps all over my body.
Oh,
wow.
And the weirdest thing is that's exactly what happened.
Wow.
I mean, it really was.
How quickly did that success with the modeling happen? And what was your first kind of big breaks that happened for you there?
The first day I was there, I got a job to do a beauty campaign for Mademoiselle magazine. Mm-hmm. And I got the job and I was going to shoot the next week. But the very day before I was going to shoot it, I got punched in the face by a bicycle delivery person. Just drove by me and punched me right in the face. And I was right down the street, right downstairs from the agency. I went running upstairs. Of course, there's blood. Once again, the rocks in my mouth. Now I get punched in the face.
Oh my God.
I know. I know. It's like I'm a target, right? It's just, what the heck? So I get punched in the face. I go up and I'm crushed because I'm thinking, well, we're not obviously going to do the beauty shoot anymore. And Mademoiselle was like, nope, we still want her. We're going to figure it out. She has a fat, my lip was sticking out. So what they did was they got a baby pool. And then we had me do a whole thing on shampoos and I had bubbles. And so I'm sitting in a baby pool, but it looks like I'm in a shower and they're holding like a handheld shower head above me.
Yeah.
So it's not on me, but it's in front of me.
Right.
So you can't really see that I have a fat lip.
It's distorting the lip, basically.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Wow.
And then I signed an exclusivity with them after I got my first cover with them after 6 weeks, but I'd already booked the cover of the New York Times Fashion of the Times and the cover of the Washington Post Fashion of the Post. So I was successful, like mad, crazy right away.
What year is this that you got there?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Summer of 81.
All right. So Robbie, when did you get there? You got there 80.
I got there summer of 82. So a year later.
Okay. So a year later, Robbie was there. So you probably saw her on the cover of these, you know, you possibly
did.
Picked it up.
Well, you would too. They were nation. Well, those two would have been finite because they are like gone in a month, right?
Right, right.
The Fashion of the Post and the Times were parts of the newspaper. But they were a big deal in the industry that I had to cover both of them. And it was like the best. They didn't let me go to Europe. Usually a model goes to Europe first.
Yeah. So you didn't go to Italy or anything?
Sheets.
Okay. They just said, we're going to do everything here.
They're going to make too much money on me staying in America.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Incredible. You kind of bypassed what every other model does and going to Europe and finding success there and kind of cutting their teeth in Europe. But you didn't do any of that. You already went straight to the big campaign.
No, which actually was safer. I had people looking out for me because I was 17 and because, you know, I was a much softer, just, you know, naive and wide-eyed and I think people just went, oh my God, do we have to protect her? She's like, I'm 6 feet tall, but I'm like a little, Maltese in size, a Great Dane body, but I was really like a little Maltese.
You're a little Iowa Maltese, Maltese from Iowa.
Funny analogy.
Okay, thank you.
That's incredible that happens so fast, so unusual.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then how did the acting, when did you go from modeling? How did that transition happen?
The first time I met my agents, Davian Littlefield was the agent representing J. Michael Bloom at the time in our modeling agency, because the models would were doing commercials.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we, right. And they wanted them to become actors. And so she said, would you like to act? And I said, okay. Because I'm not going to say no to anything, right? No. What do I need to do? And she said, nothing. And she got me into an acting class. And at first that was a little too scary because I was not ready for, I was not this angry, seasoned person yet. I dealt with my anger way later in my life.
Do you remember the teacher's name?
Stella Adler or no?
Yeah, I did go to Stella Adler. And
but that wasn't the class she put you in though, right?
No,
the initial class.
Stella was in, I don't know where she was at the time. I don't remember my very first class. I also took a sonnet class, a Shakespeare sonnet class, which I loved.
Oh, cool.
And I don't remember the name of that teacher either, but I studied with Kate McGregor Stewart for a long time, which is where we did some Sandy Meisner stuff and a lot of improv stuff. Yeah. And then we did scene study too. So there were two classes when I finally got into like really enjoying it.
Yeah.
So I was 18 and I read for this TV movie.
What network was this?
It was ABC.
ABC TV movie. Okay.
So what, I wasn't ready for the TV movie. Lynn Stallmaster was, I don't know if he did the TV movie, but I was just reading for the executive at ABC. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they put me on hold for a year. I can't remember what they paid to have me be on hold, but it wasn't like, you know, I was already modeling. So it wasn't like I wasn't making money having a job. Yeah. They weren't holding me back.
Very quickly explain to our audience what being on hold means in case someone doesn't understand that, just in layman's terms.
In layman's terms, you get a check for them to have the first right of refusal to you, really. So first right of refusal is like any other legal document. They have the first choice to use you as an actor before anybody else.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Someone else could come and ask you if you could do a film or another TV show. We have to go back to that original producer or network and ask their permission for me to get out of the contract or get a, what's it called? Like a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this is getting kind of, but there are people who are like, oh, that's really interesting. Now, this is a long time ago. I would imagine there's some things that we're probably fighting for and for our contracts now. The world is so different.
Well, it's funny you say that. I hadn't thought of it in those terms ever, but it's funny you say that because an overall deal or a holding deal like you would have gotten from ABC back in the 80s, usually they paid, you know, a token amount of money. It wasn't a ton of money.
No. And the time period, was it a year, guys? Was it a year?
Usually a year.
1 year time to have
it
you on hold.
It was a year.
Yes, where they can use you for any of their projects, first and foremost, over any other production company or network, correct? So,
correct.
Yeah, exactly. You're right, Terry. I think one of the big issues right now is these new shows, these streaming shows, when they're so short, the seasons. Eight episodes, six or eight episodes that an actor will get paid for, but then their contract holds them exclusively for that streaming show.
Yeah.
They can't do another show.
Right. Without being reimbursed. They are not reimbursed for that hold time either.
They're not
correct?
Reimbursed for the hold. And so they could sit. I mean, I know the show that I produce.
How many episodes a year do you do?
We've done different amounts every year. We started the series. I started working on it in 2019, and we have only aired two seasons so far. Our third season has finished shooting, but we haven't been able to air it because of the strikes kind of stopped everything. But I do know that our lead actor got a job he really wanted to do and during a hiatus, and they wouldn't let him do it. They said, oh, no, it competes with our sci-fi show. And he was really upset about it.
I don't blame him.
It's like what you're talking about, that holding deal you had. At least you got paid. Okay, for a year, ABC's got my attention.
Well, and I was modeling. They didn't stop me from modeling. They didn't want to stop me from being a cover girl because that's what the whole show was about.
Right.
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 But now they don't pay actors that are signed for shows. They don't pay any holding fees.
No.
To hold them for sometimes a year or two before the show finally gets on streaming. And so that is one of the things we're fighting for. That's, I love that you brought that up, because I had never thought about it before, but you're right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, just like
always happy when something parlays and
falls into place so nicely.
Yeah, so nicely.
Continue your story. Anyway,
a year later, TV movie has been filmed. It stars Daryl Hannah and Alexandra Paul. Mm-hmm. Neither of one of them want to do a series. Now ABC wants to do a series, so I auditioned for it. Mm. At the time, I did not know. I mean, they read everybody, but they had their finger on me the whole time.
Mm. Oh, wow.
You find these out later, right?
Yeah.
But at the time, I couldn't move my neck. I was so nervous. I was so excited. And Alexandra Paul and I are also another duo that maybe not now that my face has aged more, but when we were younger and more kind of like, I don't know, there's something about when your face is young, you look more kind of round and we looked more similar. We certainly look like sisters.
Hmm.
What a kind, kind woman she is. When I did the pilot, I got a message at my agency's office from her about what a fine job I had done. And it was
very sweet.
Isn't that sweet? What a sweet person. Really sweet. So the TV movie did really well. Neither Daryl Hannah nor Alexandra Paul wanted to do the TV series. Obviously, it was offered to them first. Mm-hmm. Then I read for it with Lynn Stallmaster, was a big casting director in the 80s.
Huge. Yep.
Huge. So nice. I auditioned for it. The crazy thing was, is I had been working in Europe. So I took the Concorde home because I had a job the very next day. And then at the end of that day, I had to read for Lynn Stallmaster. Like,
okay, really? I'm not even listening to Stallmaster, the audition. All I have in my mind is that you were on the Concorde.
I
never got a chance to ride on the Concorde before they decommissioned all of them. How was that? Was that like amazing?
I did it more than twice, more than three times.
You lucky dog. Oh my gosh.
So lucky. And I was on it when you could smoke on it. You were never a smoker, though, were you, Garrett?
I was.
Okay, this is so bad, but the cutest little packs of cigarettes, they come through. It was like, oh, yes, please. Can you believe we could smoke on that?
On the Concorde.
It's like this, you're like in the tube.
You're in a missile, basically, and you're smoking. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Did you feel it when you were flying in it? Could you feel the speed difference or?
There was something physical, like the sonic boom, something like a little, but there was like nothing dramatic. Like
you could get up and walk to the washroom and, you know, do your business and you're not, whoa. Like, I mean, it was just smooth, right?
Smooth. And you look out the window and it was like seeing the curvature of the earth,
yes. Right? Oh gosh. Cause your elevation is even higher. You guys are flying higher than a normal jet because you're
breaking the sound barrier, which is fast and high.
Oh my God.
Cause you don't want to hit anybody either.
No, you don't.
And the last time I went, I was 36.
Paris to LA or Paris to New York, or what were you doing? What leg was that?
Yeah, it was Paris because I hadn't been to England yet. Or it was working, I think, in Germany, and I had to take a flight from Germany to Paris to, anyway,
yes.
Who's going to this is not the part of the story that's fun.
It's not.
I want
to part of the story that's fun is I was working in Europe, had to take that Concorde over to work in America. At any rate, imagine how tired I am. And I think it's like anything. When you're my life was really glamorous, especially looking back on it. But when you're living in it and you're exhausted, I just remember days when I'd have those 9.5 hour turnarounds, like, the first year, I needed them. I wanted the money. I needed it. It felt like I was depleted. But after a while, you're like, can I just give you the money? Because I really need sleep.
Yeah.
Sleep would be my friend and yours, because I would remember my lines if I got sleep.
Exactly.
Imagine that.
My friend and yours.
And yours. So I'm doing it at the audition, and I can't get my lines right. Oh. I was so overtired and I so wanted it so badly. I was so stressed out. But the funny thing was, is everything about me doing how I did it, I was absolutely in character. I was naive. I was I was so insecure and so sorry that I wasn't getting it right. And I was younger than my years in how I was coming across.
Right.
Right. And it just naive anyway, because I'd only been out of Iowa 2 years. It's like, you don't suddenly become this like, you know, hit person coming from.
So you being flustered. Right. So your anxiety and flusteredness, it worked for the character and for the audition. Oh, I love it. You got lucky on that one. Yeah.
I got really lucky on that one. Yeah. The other naive thing was I thought because it took place in New York, I would be still living in New York.
No. So they filmed in Los Angeles for New York.
Yeah. So I relocated and it only went 13 episodes.
Wait a minute. Okay. So you moved.
That was really upsetting. Moved my whole world to Los Angeles, which I was not excited about in 1984.
What neighborhood did you stay in when you first moved there?
Of course, not a good one. Gower and Sunset. I was staying at a friend of a friend's house because they were out of the country. And so I was, and there were raccoons in the walls. I was so terrified. I was such an apartment person. It was like, no, this like anybody could break into the house. There's no dog. I didn't know what to do. It was crazy.
That's funny. Oh, the first time I went to LA was around 1984 to do an episode of a TV show. Yeah. And instead of staying at the hotel that the network was going to put me up at, I had a friend from New York, a Broadway theater person, friend of mine, who said, Grover Dale and Anita Morris. Grover Dale was a big Broadway choreographer, and they have a house in Laurel Canyon, and they've got a guest house. And they'll just go stay at Grover and Anita's house. So I go up to the guest house in Laurel Canyon, coming from New York City, like you're describing. And I feel like I'm in the middle of like nowhere. Laurel Canyon.
It's terrifying.
It was terrifying. And I'm staying in this like shack, basically. It was barely a guest house. And then at night I hear the coyotes.
Coyotes
in Laurel Canyon are loud. And they seem like they were right outside the walls, these paper thin
walls. They were.
Guest house. I'm sure they were. I was terrified. I want to get back to New York City so bad. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's funny.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I kept going. I kept trying to get back to New York. And every time I would just get settled in New York, I would end up getting a job and have to go back to LA.
Wow. Yeah.
So I also got into Uta Hagen's acting class. It was like, oh, Uta Hagen's. Oh my God. I'm going to really.
Deal.
Yeah. And auditioning was so scary. But then I couldn't go to class because we weren't filming in New York. And there
I'm thinking,
you know, like Woody Allen, dream come true. I'm going to work in New York, study in New York.
Uta
eventually
Hagen,
I'll be on stage.
You were accepted into Uta Hagen's class and you could not take the class because you weren't in the city. So, that sucks.
What did you do when you made this transition to acting? So you'd been, you know, super successful very quickly, just, you know, off the plane from Iowa. And then 2 years later, you're starting to do all this acting. What did you start to do like for your creative process? What kinds of things were you studying? Mm-hmm. Like if you couldn't get into Uta's class or couldn't make that work out, was there other coaches or people that you were studying with?
Oh yeah. I was studying with Kate McGregor Stewart. And I think at that time in New York City, she probably, did every scene I could do with her until I had to move to LA. And then when I lived in LA, a couple of friends in mine and I, this is before I left for LA, went to see Kevin Bacon and Sean Penn. Oh, what's the name of that play?
Slab Boys. I know the play.
Yes.
Slab Boys. I saw
and
it. Yes.
We went and so made friends. I mean, I'm not I just shook Kevin Bacon's hand. So I have that 6 degrees.
Six degrees of Kevin Bacon. Yes.
But I don't know him. But Sean Penn, when I got to LA, his dad directed a few episodes and he recommended I go to Bill Traylor and Peggy Fury's acting classes, where Laura Dern was in those classes. And so was Eric Stoltz. He used to tease me relentlessly.
When you did make the move to Los Angeles, at that point, did you completely sever ties with modeling, or was modeling still kind of a backup until you, you know, found something even more secure?
No, because at that time, that's a really good question. At that time in the world, if you were doing both, you couldn't do both, really. It was okay. like you weren't respected, or you had this, anyway, you had this idea that you wouldn't be respected, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And on top of it, the agent at the time, he's no longer with us, but they wanted 20%. And my agent was making 10%, my acting it. So you can't take 30%.
Right. No.
And he wasn't having anything to do with that. So we had a terrible severing of our relationship, which is really funny too, at the time, when you think about how they talk to you when you're a teenager, as if they're dealing with another adult.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. It's like, I was 19, a 50-year-old man's talking to me like I'm a 30-year-old woman. I'm 19. I've only lived in New York City for a minute. Yeah. I'm not spoiled. I just don't understand how all of these things work.
Yeah.
So people need to sit you down and have a calm conversation about what's happening. Not these dramatic fights. It's just, oh my gosh. It says a lot about where a lot of us come from drama. And it just parlays into it instead of people taking it down a notch.
Yeah. I feel like the culture of Hollywood or modeling or show business, all of it. I think back to the early 80s when I first got to New York, and you were certainly much more successful than I was in those years. But I do remember some of the stuff happening in the 80s, and the culture was it was bullying. There was a lot of bullying.
Yeah.
And
that's not good.
And shaming. I don't know if
shaming
they
and fear and
body shaming. Oh, it'll ruin your career. It was like, I can't ruin my career. It's like, I don't even know what that, I'm from a normal place.
Yeah, I don't know what a show business career is.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a lot of what, like, I know that SAG-AFTRA is really not just, some of the things that this strike is about is not just about money, but it's about workplace conditions and safety and respect in the workplace and all those things.
Oh, yes.
You know,
and Me
stuff
Too
that
brought a lot of it to the head, but people still get away with a lot of stuff. It's like most things, when it's immediate in the news and the headlines and it's brand new, people are really scared. And then when time goes by and people just sort of sneak back into their old behavior.
Robbie, you said your first time out in LA was 84, is what you said?
I think it was 84.
Okay.
I think so. 84, and 85.
When Olympics happening?
Like, maybe it was the year after that, then. Might have been 85. No. I don't know. It was one of, I can't remember.
It was in the mid-80s.
Yes.
It was the mid-80s.
But Terry,
it was a blur.
For you, it was 84 that you were there on Sunset and Gower, staying in that area, 84, summer of 84, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So check it out. If Robbie was then there at 84, that's the same year that you got there. And for me, that's when I was in my freshman year of college orientation, was summer of 84. Before I was a freshman.
Oh, you went to college.
At UCLA, yes. So I graduated.
You went to UCLA?
Yeah, so I was in LA when you guys.
Getting educated.
I was in LA when you guys were there too, at the same time.
That's
basically
amazing.
Yeah, but.
It was a much smaller town.
It's more amazing that we're not from
then.
There.
Yes.
Yeah, wasn't it? And there was rush hour. There were rush hours.
Yeah.
Like if you made an appointment for 11, you wouldn't be crushed with traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You definitely wouldn't be crushed first thing in the morning. Like, 9:30, it'd be like, oh, yay.
Did you guys go to that nightclub Vertigo? That was like the big nightclub back in the 80s, mid 80s. I don't know.
I remember going there, but you couldn't do anything because you get carded. You can't drink till you're 21.
Where was Vertigo? Yeah, where
was
it?
True. Somewhere in Hollywood.
Under the Beverly Center?
Under the Beverly Center? Oh, no.
Oh, I remember that club.
What's that
there was
one?
One that was one? Down below the Beverly Center. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Just off San Vicente. I remember
I
that
don't
one.
Remember that
That's
one.
The one I remember. But I do remember. Oh, wait. Vertigo. It was on La Cienega.
I that think was that a little sounds later. Right. Yeah. A little bit later. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Garrett was a club guy. I was
No, I was not during college, not until I was on the show that I turned into a club guy. That's when I was going
to
Vegas.
Dancing.
And yeah,
that was
yeah.
the fun part.
Dancing is great.
So different projects coming along. How did you feel creatively that your confidence in acting and being a performer like that grew or changed from modeling in your very first pilot and series? Into the other projects you started doing? Like, when did you start to feel like, oh yeah, I know what I'm doing? Or how did you get to that place?
I think one of the things that helped is modeling in a sense, the structure of your life is very similar when you're doing guest stars. And that you go on a trip, you're with like 10 people, they're the same people, 10 people for 10 days. And then the next trip, a whole new set of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you just get used to working with new people, and you have to, you get used to like, there's that, well, let's make it to Friday. And if they're still nice by Friday.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So try not to get too excited the first couple of days. So there's the rhythm of all of that, but I don't know. I think it was just working with being in class probably gave me more confidence than anything.
Yeah.
And then really what makes it difficult, even thinking about it now, is when there's time, big chunks of time when you aren't working. Then it feels really nerve-wracking. Or when someone's smiling, a producer's smiling to your face, but you hear from your agent they're not happy. Then it's sort of like, what do I do? I don't know how to fix it. And I think that's when it gets difficult. But the joy of trusting it to a certain degree, and watching other people fail too, and think, well, we're all learning in front of camera. It's on the job training, really, because it's nothing like acting class. It really isn't. It's so different. Yeah, you get so much more time in acting class.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important to do. You need to get up and fail in front of people.
Yeah. I say that sometimes to actors that I work with, that they sort of bring in a mindset like, oh, well, we have the time or the ability to experiment or try things. I'm like, this is an acting class. I literally had to say that. Like, we're not in class right now.
This
is what the writer intended. And sure, there's a million possibilities in acting class, but not here.
Not here.
We're actually telling a story that's very specific. And so we need to tell it this way, and we need to do it quickly, like we have a lot of shots.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to be the tough guy, but sometimes I've had to literally say that, like, that's for acting class, and that's a great place to go and stretch and try things. But this is not that. This is delivering. This is your professional actors, and
absolutely. I do want to say one thing too about modeling. I was lucky enough to work for the magazines a lot. And when you work on the magazines, you're creating a picture.
Yeah.
So obviously they are controlling the bigger vision, but you're part of the artistry of that. So in a sense, it is an acting lesson when you're doing that. And, you know, certainly on a minor, just even, you know, you could be sick and you're still looking good, posing, doing your thing. There are still little elements of getting used to, big element, the camera. There are a lot of actors that get freaked out about the camera. And once you've modeled, the only thing that you have to remember is to not look in it.
Yeah.
It's like, just don't look at the camera. Okay. It's not like every modeling job, I always look right into the camera.
Yeah. You're right. I've never thought of it that way, but as a model, there's an element of performance, you know, no matter how you feel, you got to bring a certain performance, and there's a story to the shot you're telling too. There's a story of whatever that story is, that without words, you've got to create a story.
And the clothes are creating that too. And you're in a costume, and you can take it apart, or you can make it add to your, experience.
It's interesting you bring up modeling and clothes and kind of using the clothes to tell a story. Did you find as an actress that you were more aware than maybe other actors about the clothes and how they told the story because of coming from a modeling background?
I don't know. I couldn't talk about, I think that's such an element of acting to have the clothes talk about your character. I wouldn't think that I could compare whether you, the three of us, we'd have to say who cares more about or is more aware of the clothes.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, personally, for me, I never thought about the clothes. Like I never, it just wasn't something. And I'm not saying that that's better or worse. It's just, I probably should have thought more, but I was like, okay, what do you want me to wear? Sure. I'll wear that. Like I, you know, how do you want to do my hair? I didn't think about those things as much. And I probably should have, like you say, that
maybe
the modeling,
that's something, yeah. But maybe that has something to do with why you enjoy directing so much.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, you're like delegating that.
I think about it as a director more like, no, that's, you know, as I'm looking at other people, I'm very aware, is that telling the right story? Is there a way that we can dress them that enhances their experience as a character? I think about that a lot, but as an actor, I didn't.
You didn't think about that at all, basically.
Yeah.
I think I used to worry about things looking authentic or inauthentic in clothes.
Yeah.
But also, one of the things I really didn't like was how they kind of overdo my hair. And it's like, how are these actors, actresses having their hair look like normal hair? And you've got hot rollers in my hair and I look like I have a helmet on. How hard is it to just have somebody let me have
just
my hair?
Regular hair, not all done up. Yeah.
Like,
did they do that when you were when you were modeling? Did they do work your hair as much as when you were acting?
Oh, because because the hairdresser is also it's his shot too. Mm-hmm, so there's a tear sheet. Every person that contributes, it's not unlike acting jobs. Everybody who contributes wants to take that film, whether it be a photograph or moving pictures, and use it as part of their see, this is my experience and I was a part of this, and these are my choices that help contribute to the story or the picture or whatever, right?
For their portfolio.
And we all want to have part of that tell our story and how our artistry gives, you know. But the hair thing would drive me mad, and makeup too. Like, way too much makeup on, and it's like, oh, come on.
Did you talk about Ivana Chubbuck at all? Did you get into that story? No.
No.
Okay.
Okay. Here's the thing. When I started, they didn't really know what they wanted me to do. And I, on the show that we can't really talk about, and them not being happy with me in particular, I think they really wanted me to be more stoic. And I just couldn't really understand how somebody who was 350 years old and had been a man and a woman in many lifetimes, to me, would not be a stoic person in that sort of shut down emotionally, very, not like unlike Jerry's character, right? Very non-emotional. To me, I thought, well, I can't wrap my brain around being anything but massively curious.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm alive that long, and I'm still curious about beings, whatever they are, I'm the oldest person here. I've been where you are at one lifetime or another, at one point in my development or another. So I have compassion and empathy for every single one of you. So I would have to kind of laugh at humanity and get a chuckle out of, you know, like how having kids, your kids do silly things. And sometimes it hurts their feelings that you're laughing at them. And you're like, oh my gosh, you have no idea how cute you are right now. Yeah. And you're trying so hard as a parent to just put a lid on it.
Yeah.
So there's that element to it. So when they sent me to go meet Ivana Chubbuck, actually the director, who I can't think of, and it's because I have a mind block because he was not kind to me at all. Oh. But the kindness he did give me was introducing me to Ivana. Hmm. So we're working on the script together, and she's, let's just read this. So we did, and she said, you have no problem with your acting. Here's what they want. They don't want you to be all of my sense of humor. They want to eradicate it. She said, but I don't think that's a strong choice. I don't think that's a good choice, because I think you do really well at making that turn in the dialogue. You're finding that, you're finding what's underneath the lines. Uh-huh. So she said, what I really see is that you need someone to run lines, and I'm happy to take their money. So why don't we meet and we'll
I love it. Oh,
she
that's
coached
awesome.
Me through stuff, and like,
yeah,
she taught me how she teaches,
yeah,
which was really helpful to me, because I was obviously not being able to bring the Bill Traylor and Peggy Fury were method actors,
right?
They were from Stella. I also took from Stella, but this Adler. Is way after. Yeah. So Ivana really helped me a lot. And in my confidence too, if it's not you, you're not crazy. You're not doing it. They're asking something that doesn't work really. And it's flat without you being comic relief as well. And I wasn't being crazy comic relief. It was
your interpretation of the character. If your character's been around that long, you would be amused by all the silliness of humanity. Why would you be this stoic, detached person in the background? Like, it didn't agree with how you saw the character, it sounds like. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that. I remember, and I've talked about this with Garrett before, but we had a lunch before we launched our series, our sci-fi series.
Yeah.
And we were explicitly told that because there's rubber on people's faces and everything's so larger than life, we were explicitly told no acting. Just, we want things almost military. We want it dry.
Yeah,
like the more acting, the more feelings that you have, the more silly this whole world feels. Yeah. So you need to bring it down. You're explicitly told that. I remember that and thinking, so I think they had and whether it was
techno babble, it made sense. Mm-hmm. I'm not making a joke out of techno babble, not when I'm doing my job.
Right. Yeah. You were not going to joke
But there's just this sense of this wry dryness you want to have.
Sure.
We're human beings.
It's also funny. If you watch the new sci-fi series shows that are out, the style of acting is very different than we were kind of
in the 90s.
Yes. We were in a very tightly controlled style of acting. Mm-hmm. And now these new shows have all kinds of human experiences.
There's so much more loosey-goosey than we were back in the 90s.
It's closer to the original.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish we could have all of us.
It's just closer to real life. That's it. You know, it'd been nice if we could have done that for sure.
I think you're on the right track is my point. You had it right.
You didn't need Ivana Chubbuck. You could have did it on your own.
You know what? but I did need her because she helped build my confidence.
Yes, and
she taught me how to break down a script in a way that I hadn't learned before.
Oh, so, can you share that with us? I'd like to know that. I'm just curious. I never studied with her.
Taking my personal life, what's happening right now today, and interjecting it into it's kind of like method in that I'm taking a real life thing that works for me so using a real frustration but not kind of doing it a long thing about it. It would be like I am pretending I'm talking to this one person in my life that I'm really angry with. And I'm angry with your character. So you're not really there for me. I'm using this other person as to drive my emotion. Just like when I was saving somebody and it was life or death, and it was really something that I was on edge about, I would use my sister and my nieces and nephews as my that's who my goal was, to protect them.
Yeah.
That was my substitution.
Right.
But it wasn't like method where I thought about it a great deal or anything like that. It felt more like Sir Laurence Olivier say, how about you just try acting?
Okay.
But I used that.
So you came.
But I'm using them to plug in there because you have to have something going on in your brain.
Yeah.
You can't just. Or you're not interesting to watch.
Okay. Am I right to say this, Terry? You're using your real life as a spark plug that you think about for a split second and it gets you into the scene and that's it. You don't keep thinking about it. Like standard, typical old school method is you stay in that character. You stay in that circumstance no matter what happens. Even when they stop rolling the cameras, you're still that character and you're still living that substitution forever.
I can't do that.
You can't. So you're quickly in it and then out is what Chubbuck would teach you. Okay.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, and would write those substitutions in. She also helped me with some TV movies that I did too. When the dialogue and everything made more sense and it was easier for me to memorize, then it felt like I could be a little more indulgent on sticking with my substitution or just really it's whatever works in that moment, isn't it? I mean, that's what it is. If a sense memory, like listening to a certain song makes you really sad and you have to be crying in a scene and you listen to that song before, or if you need menthol in your eyes, I used to have so much pride. No, I have to get there myself. And then there's a point where you're just like, oh, can we write it up here? Let's write it here. And there, then give me a little Vaseline or a little, you know, mixed maple rub and all that.
Right.
You know, it just, there's a point where we just don't have time to get all fussy with it.
Yeah.
Let's tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's more than one way to get to the final destination. So, and you know, we use what we can use, what we need to use to get there. I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, if we all had a lot of money, like, did you see, oh, never mind. I'd have to say too many things that would not be okay.
Well, tell us off record. What was it?
Okay.
I'm just curious.
Well, The Whale. I saw Brendan Fraser interviewed about The Whale. Did you see that interview? And he talked about he couldn't get to the place he wanted to be. And the director, they shot it the next day. But he talked about how as an actor, sometimes you just can't get to the place that you want to be at for whatever reason. Yeah. You're tired. You didn't eat right. Or whatever this array of things are. It was just an off day.
Yeah.
And they were blessed with being able to have another day. That we did not have that. And TV actors don't have that indulgence. Or that creative freedom or that kind of money to have the creative freedom to take another day.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So one you need to sometimes write it down.
Yeah. One last question for me about your creativity. It's a collaboration question. You know, how does collaboration work, whether it's with other actors or with directors or writers? Like, do you talk about scenes with other actors, like the detail of how, or do you just kind of wait and see how it's going to go? Or how's that process, you know, worked for you collaborating with people?
I think it kind of depends on who you're with or the situation you're in, because if you're with people that like to rehearse, then it's great. Then it's fun to talk about it all or, you try to get all the juice out of it. And I feel like if you have the opportunity to, it's always better if you can rehearse it to the point where you just know it and then you can relax and just listen and just be in it and see where that takes you. Right. Cause you've done that homework, but we all three know they're doing the shows we've done. That's a luxury to get to do that.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you can have the luxury, I would give my own time to do the rehearsal, you know, but then again, that's probably something in our striking, it gets sticky because people want to get paid for their time.
But I
think the product looks better if you, it's not like what's your, you know, I think Rodney said to Keith Gordon, like, what is your face looking like when I say such and such? It's like, it's not like that. it's more like, well, let me see your character so I can listen to you and feel like, who are we in this together? Because you're creating it together, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like to talk about it. I think it's interesting and fun. And
yeah, it sounds like you were in the sci-fi world that we were all a part of. It sounds like you were very thoughtful, you know, working with acting coaches, and it sounds like you really put a lot of thought and a lot of creativity and passion into the work. So
thank you. Yeah, I do miss really that part. I miss that. I miss the camaraderie.
All right. Well, we just want to say thank you so much to Terry Farrell for joining us for our weekly Delta Flyers podcast. Thank you once again, Terry. And thank Terry again, because she's going to hang out with us for a little bit longer. For all of you Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material, where you will get a little more Terry Farrell, which is always a good thing. Yes. All right. Thanks, Terry. Once again.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, guys. I am so excited, and I love hanging out with you.
Yay. Yeah,
that's really
thank
fun.
Thank you. Awesome. And I look forward to meeting all of you guys on the other end of this, right?
There you go.
That's right.